Today is Monday, December 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, darkness at one of the world's busiest airports.
When we arrived, the terminal was like completely dark, no power at all.
The UN Security Council plans to vote on reversing President Trump's declaration on Israel. The inferno of California's largest wildfire continues to threaten thousands of homes.
As of this morning, we are the third largest fire in California history.
Also ahead, a short film with a big message. It's all on today's International Edition. A sudden power outage brought the world's busiest airport to a standstill Sunday, grounding scores of flights in Atlanta just days before the start of the Christmas travel rush. Passengers at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport were left in the dark when the lights suddenly went out in the early afternoon on Sunday. The blackout halted all outgoing flights, and arriving planes were held on the ground at their point of departure. International flights were being diverted. Joining me now from Atlanta is VOA Turkish Service reporter Mehtap Yilmaz. Mehtap, I understand you got caught up in all of it. You were not able to fly back to D.C., and you're in Atlanta now. What happened as far as you know?
So we arrived at the airport. My flight was initially at 3 p.m., and we dropped our car off, rental car area, and we realized, you know, that terminal train was stopped. There was a power outage, so we had to wait for shuttles. After waiting like 30 minutes, I realized there's nothing like moving over there. So we found someone, managed to find an Uber to get the terminal. So we managed to get terminal. When we arrived at the terminal was like completely dark, no power at all.
Wow.
So people were waiting for, like, you know, nobody has answers. We're trying to ask people over there, Delta people or other TSA people, they don't know what's happening over there. So people were waiting, like everybody was waiting for, you know, no reason.
Hmm.
So we didn't get any answers. So we were managed to, most of the lines were not working, like Sprint or AT&T. Only my phone was working. I was able to make phone calls at least,
mm-hmm.
So there was no data coverage as well. So I called my friends in Atlanta, you know, to ask them what's happening, and they told me there's a power outage. So we waited there about 2 hours. So lines were not moving, and there's actually no line too. People were sitting on the floor.
Hmm. So was the airport pretty crowded at that point?
It is, extremely crowded. It's like holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thousands of people.
And did you ever get any explanation as to what happened?
No one told anything. We tried to reach out to people, and the only answer we had was, like, we have never seen something like this before.
Hmm.
We have never experienced something like this before. That was the answer we have.
So basically everything came to a standstill. No flights in or out with no power,
no
I would imagine.
No flights. Everything is canceled so far. They try to reschedule, obviously. We are trying to reach out the airlines, you know, see what we have. And the phones were not working. That was the worst part. I mean, you don't know what's happening. It could be like terrorist attack. It could be anything like security.
Right.
You know.
If they didn't know what it was, I would imagine they didn't know when it could be restored.
Yes, that's the situation right now. I mean, that was until I left there. Which I'm still trying to go back to, you know, downtown city. And the most people are like, their luggage are, like, they just checked in their luggage and they cannot take it back. So that's another issue.
Wow.
And the arrival flights, the people were, telling us, like, they waited, like, 2 hours in the plane to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So no in, no out right now.
Busy holiday season and the busiest airport in the world. So not a good combination at all.
Exactly. And it's raining here. It's the worst. And cold.
So what are you going to do?
We just called our friends here, and we might probably going to stay in their house. And then I'll try to find the earliest possible flight to go back home, D.C.
All right. That's VOA Turkish Service reporter Mehtap Yilmaz, thanks for being with us. The airport has more than 2,500 daily arrivals and departures, bringing more than 250,000 passengers through that airport on an average day. Georgia Power says full power will be restored by midnight local time on Monday. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Russia says U.S. CIA information thwarted an attack in St. Petersburg. Israel will probe the fatal shooting of a Palestinian paraplegic. A report slams local and U.S. hurricane response in Puerto Rico. And President Trump smells victory on U.S. tax overhaul. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The UN Security Council will vote on Monday on a draft resolution that would affirm any action to change the status of Jerusalem would have no legal effect. It's meant to reject U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Egypt requested the vote on Sunday, a day after it presented the measure that's likely to be vetoed by the United States. Breaking with the international consensus, Trump this month announced that he'd recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv, sparking protests and strong condemnation. Israel seized control of the eastern part of the city in the 1967 Middle East War and seized the whole of Jerusalem as its undivided capital. Palestinians view the city's east as the capital of their future state. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Michael Fishbach, professor of history at Randolph-Macon College in Virginia, what the point of the council's vote on Monday is.
For decades, actually going back to 1947, when the United Nations voted to partition Palestine into an Arab state, which never occurred, a Jewish state, which did occur, the state of Israel. And the partition vote said that the area around Jerusalem would be an international zone, so-called in Latin, corpus separatum, that would belong to neither of those two states. Ever since then, the global community has agreed not to establish embassies, either in what used to be, before 1967, Israeli West Jerusalem and Jordanian East Jerusalem. Since 67, Israel has controlled the entire city. But the international community, there's been a consensus that until the Arab-Israeli conflict is resolved finally and peacefully, no country wants to prejudice the outcome of what's going to happen to Jerusalem, because the original UN decision was that it would be held in an international zone. So there's been this, as I said, this global agreement since then about Jerusalem, and that has been pervasive. And President Trump's decision really overturned decades of not only U.S., that is to say, East Jerusalem, the old city and its suburbs, are considered by the UN and the international community to be occupied territory. And therefore, no change in that status, that sense of being occupied, can be tolerated by the global community on the part of anybody, the United States or anyone else. And that's really what's being expressed here, is that from 47, again in 67, there's been this sense of here is what must happen in Jerusalem. And the Trump administration's decision has completely upended that.
Turkey announced it will open an embassy in East Jerusalem days after leading calls at a summit of Muslim leaders for the world to recognize it as the capital of Palestine. Is this a problem for the U.S. and for the international community?
Well, it's a problem for the United States in the sense of Turkey is a NATO ally. But it's also an ally that has drawn considerable scrutiny and criticism, both within the United States and from other quarters, for its recent slide toward an increasingly authoritarian government under Tayyip Erdogan, as well for the fact that despite decades of somewhat close ties, in the past 15 years, Israeli-Turkish relations have also deteriorated. So from the United States' point of view, to see two of its main Middle Eastern allies in such open conflict with one another is troublesome. For the global community, I'm not sure it is so much a problem, but it does symbolize one thing. From France to even Russia and now Turkey, other actors are moving up, in their view, essentially to take the place of the United States as the leading actor in trying to do something on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So the Trump administration, which has said for a year now that it has some grand deal in place, really that sense of American, in essence, ownership of the peace process is being openly called into question by various actors, including in this case Turkey.
Vice President Mike Pence and Mideast negotiator Jason Greenblatt are due in the region later this week. What might they accomplish?
Well, honestly speaking, I don't think much. Egyptian President Anwar Sadat once famously said in the early 1970s that America holds 99% of the cards in the Middle East. He said, like it or not, only the United States has the global power and the more specific power to leverage Israel to make some sort of deal possible. So really, the entire Arab world and the Middle East recognize that without the United States, there really can be no forward movement on the peace process. But this recent decision has turned many in the Middle East against the United States even more so, including, as you said, non-Arab actors such as Turkey. So I don't see how the upcoming visit of American officials can do much. Having said that, though, I will say that much of the Arab world has reacted somewhat less strongly than the Palestinians would have liked. The Saudis really, particularly under the Crown Prince, view Iran as the main problem in the region, not the unresolved Arab-Israeli conflict. Israel and Saudi Arabia in many ways share very much in terms of fear of Iran, fear of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And so while the Palestinians and some of their allies, including Jordan, may fume, there's in a sense really not much they can do. So certainly people will meet with the visiting Americans, but really what's going to happen, I think, is going to depend on a number of factors, some of which have really nothing to do with Jerusalem.
That's Michael Fishbach, professor of history at Randolph-Macon College in the U.S. state of Virginia. Thousands of delegates from South Africa's ruling ANC party began voting for their new leader in the early hours of Monday morning, shortly after saying the vote had been delayed. The conference on the outskirts of Johannesburg brings to an end embattled President Jacob Zuma's two terms as head of the party.
Not long time ago, comrades felt I should be talked to step down. And I want to say to you all here, comrades, that I bear no grudge. You are my comrades. You are expressing your views.
Zuma made no attempt to hide his pick, though, for his successor as his party met to vote over new leadership, delivering several backhands at his deputy, successful businessman Cyril Ramaphosa.
Standing here, I'm waiting for one leader to emerge whom I'm going to call my president.
Delegates are choosing between two candidates to lead Nelson Mandela's historic liberation movement. Thousands of firefighters tried Sunday to shield coastal communities from one of the biggest wildfires in California history, while a funeral procession rolled past burn-scarred hillsides in honor of one of their colleagues killed battling the flames. The fire that started nearly 2 weeks ago has burned at least 750 homes. Some 18,000 more are still threatened. Thousands of firefighters from nearly a dozen states are battling the fire, which is the third largest wildfire in state history.
So some of the conditions that the firefighters were facing last night, we were expected the sundowners to hit somewhere between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. So strong winds out of the north pushing the fire back downhill. So extremely gusty, cold, and, you know, relatively humidity being low. It's a very hazardous firefight.
Calmer winds a day after gusts fanned a flare-up that prompted more evacuations. Thousands of residents scrambled to grab their belongings.
I'm sure other people have a lot more stuff, but we picked out the valuable items that we couldn't replace.
The more than 1,000 square kilometer blaze called the Thomas Fire has cremated entire neighborhoods and now threatens an area known for its star power, including the mansions of Oprah Winfrey, Ellen DeGeneres, and many other celebrities. The cause remains under investigation. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello. Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now, turning to social media. We are joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. What's the latest?
Well, we have an update on a story that we talked about last week, Lori. You might remember Chamath Palihapitiya. He is the former vice president of global growth at Facebook. And he was in the news last week because he said basically that social media, including Facebook, are feedback loops, that they lead to the kind of degradation of society and just all these negative things that he had to say about social and digital media. Well, saying after Facebook responded specifically to his comments, Chamath Palihapitiya is on Facebook this weekend, basically walking back his comments. He said that he thinks that Facebook is a force for good in the world, and he wanted to expand on his comments and said that he wanted to start a conversation, not to criticize a company, particularly one he loves. And he goes on to kind of walk back a lot of what he said and said that it's the issue of how people use Facebook, not the social platform itself, that is the problem. Again, this was something that Facebook responded to specifically, which is very rare. Often they issue these blanket statements. They don't often mention someone very specifically like this, but perhaps because of Facebook's comments, he decided he was going to walk back his. Unclear exactly why that was. Mm-hmm. Now, while that's going on, Facebook, as part of their series called Hard Questions, is talking specifically about the issue of social media and how it's used and how it can make people angry or depressed or sad. And it's kind of interesting. Facebook says that it's not so much the social network, it's how people are using them that's the problem. Of course, they're kind of pushing the blame off on the users rather than themselves. Facebook says that the issue is when you go on social media and you look at what other people are doing, you can get depressed because you feel like you're missing out. But when you go on social media and you comment and you share and you like and you're participatory, that can actually add value to your life. So kind of interesting that Facebook is pushing that off on the users, and very interesting that they say, well, if you're only if you were more active on Facebook, you would have a better time and your life would be better. I think it's being met with a little bit of cynicism from people saying, of course, Facebook's going to say that.
All right, Andrew, thank you. And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, it's been a winter wonderland near Washington, D.C. this holiday season, as it has been for the last 9 years. It's all about an exhibit called ICE, and to it took more than 200 to make it. It took more than 2 million pounds of ice to create sculptures that fill a huge indoor park. VOA's Yoon Jung Cho reports.
Ready, set, go!
Riding on a giant two-story ice slide seems to get people into the holiday spirit. It is part of the ICE exhibit at the Gaylord National Resort near Washington, D.C. In its ninth year, this winter wonderland is kept at a chilly minus 13 Celsius.
The slides are, they're ice, and you don't find that everywhere. And I think it's amazing that they can make a slide out of ice.
The rides are fun and popular with children and also the young at heart.
Oh, I think they're grown-ups as well, especially those of us who love to be little kids again, who never got enough of having fun. So it's great. I love it. My husband, he likes to see me happy and act like a little girl.
More than 2 million pounds of ice are used to carve out scenes from Christmas favorites like the movie Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. The 1,400 square meter indoor park is packed with colorful ice sculptures.
I think they're just blown away by these colorful sculptures. It's not something that you would typically see. When you hear of ice sculptures, you think of the clear ice, and you see these vibrant colors. We have 14 different colors in the show, so I think that just is like awe. Like, a lot of people don't believe it's real when they're walking through, so it's definitely a sight to see. And then we do end our scenes with a nativity scene, which is all crystal clear ice.
35 artisans from Harbin and Inner Mongolia, China, famous for ice and snow sculptures, traveled all the way to the U.S. to create this exhibit. It took them more than a month.
Even though it makes me very tired, I have no complaint. After we finish ice, you look at it and you see people enjoying it. It gives me great satisfaction and I am proud in this job.
200,000 visitors are expected this year. Eun Jung Cho, VOA News, Washington.
Well, every year an estimated 600,000 families in the United States, including more than a million children, experience homelessness. Under these heartbreaking circumstances, no one would fault a child that's dealing with homelessness to feel despair. It could impact motivation, relationships, and even school performance. But one teenager has beat the odds.
When I was homeless, I kind of thought it wouldn't be like too long. This is just like really temporary. That's my greatest achievement, I guess, is just maintaining the straight A's during that time. I was just really determined.
That's the story of Angelique, a powerful one, and it's been turned into a less than 12-minute film that packs a lot of messages into a very short movie. It's on YouTube and Glamour.com. And joining us now is the film's director, Cameron Bargerstock. Thanks for being with us. So this is a really moving and inspiring story, packing a lot of stuff in there. How did the making of this movie even come about?
So I've always been drawn to coming-of-age stories. You know, the teenage years are all about kind of the search for identity and meaning and surviving. And I really wanted to make a story that explored how a young person deals with kind of heavy-hitting real-world issues. And Condé Nast Entertainment was excited to partner with me on a story. And we decided we wanted to make it about a teen girl who really rose above seemingly insurmountable odds.
Well, this one, boy, she sure, I mean, unbelievable. I know many adults who would have crumbled. I mean, how did you even find her, Angelique?
So I found Angelique through a social worker at her high school. I told them a little bit about what I wanted to do, and they handpicked several students for me to meet. And immediately, Angelique stood out. She was kind of such a quiet but strong presence. You know, she was shy and introspective, but she was so honest and candid and clear, and I thought she was going to be perfect for this project.
It's really hard to believe, just like her friend said in the film, you know, that, you know, a girl that looked so put together, that did well in school, that was so committed to her studies and committed to improving her life, was for a time dealing with food insecurity, housing insecurity, a mother with mental illness, and sleeping in a car and yet going to school every day. I mean, that's unbelievable. Mm-hmm.
Pretty unbelievable. I mean, I was so struck by, she has a very complicated relationship with her mother who suffers from bipolar disorder, and just how this mental illness had like a cascade effect on their life. It led to the food insecurity and housing insecurity and homelessness and kind of the loss of a lot of opportunities that her other friends definitely had.
Absolutely. And I also thought it was fascinating that the grandmother was sort of, it was the three of them that were literally homeless and living in a car. That's three generations of women dealing with this situation.
It's true. It's pretty incredible. Some of the photos Angelique showed me of them living in their car during the dead of winter. And, you know, how she was able to do her homework and still show up for class and no one know, you know, that she didn't get good sleep and that she was cold all night and maybe didn't even eat dinner. You know, I followed her around for a few days and saw her in theater class. And, you know, she's a shy girl, but when she gets on stage, she just exudes such depth and such power. And I'm really so inspired spending time with Angelique.
Did she say how she maintained her positivity?
I think she didn't exactly say how she did it, but I think it was for survival. I think that she, in many ways, really held the family together, her grandmother and her mother. Her father is not in the picture.
Right.
And I think that was the only way she really could survive and potentially have the opportunity to rise above it.
Right. again, very inspiring that she could maintain that positive attitude in a situation where she would have had every right not to be. The film really packs a powerful message, or a lot of messages, into just a little over 11 minutes, I believe. Food, like we were talking about, food and housing insecurity, homelessness, mental illness. There are a lot of, 600,000 families that are homeless in the United States, and apparently 1.3 million of them are children. That's a striking number.
It really is. And, you know, what separates those who are able to kind of break free from that cycle and those who don't, I mean, I don't know what the formula is or what separates those.
The number of people that are homeless and the number of them are children. We don't think about that children in our country, in the United States of America, could be sleeping in a car with two other people every night. So what do you hope viewers will take away from this movie?
Well, on one level, for other young people who are in similar positions or kind of dealing with these really profound challenges in their life, I hope this film gives them hope. And I really want to inspire young people to share their voice and to really spread stories of resilience and courage in the face of adversity. What happened to Anjali? She got a full ride to attend the University of Southern California, where she'll be studying theater and psychology. And really her mission in life is to really understand her mother. And she feels like through studying psychology and learning about mental health, mental illness, she can really make a difference. And I really think she's going to be a leader.
That's director Cameron Bargerstock. Her film, Anjalique, available for viewing on YouTube and Glamour.com. That does it for today's edition of International Edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, is an indispensable pillar to maintain peace and stability in Europe and Eurasia. Of all the challenges confronting the OSCE today, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said at the recent OSCE Ministerial Council, none is more important or vexing than the situation in Ukraine. The United States is committed to Ukraine's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity within its internationally recognized borders. Secretary Tillerson called for the full implementation of the Minsk agreements, adding, "We will never accept Russia's occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea." Furthermore, he said, Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns full control of the peninsula to Ukraine. The United States joins its European partners in maintaining sanctions until Russia withdraws its forces from the Donbas and meets its Minsk commitments. Secretary Tillerson noted that while Ukraine is taking steps to abide by these agreements, and it must continue to do so, Russia is not. Indeed, more civilians were killed in 2017 than in 2016, and in November, ceasefire violations in Donetsk and Luhansk were up significantly, according to the OSCE's Special Monitoring Mission, or SMM, to Ukraine. We should be clear about the source of this violence, Secretary Tillerson stressed. Russia is arming, training, leading, and fighting alongside anti-government forces. The United States calls on Russia and its proxies to end its harassment, intimidation, and its attacks on the SMM. The United States honors the sacrifices of Joseph Stone, an American paramedic killed while on patrol in eastern Ukraine in April 2017, and commends the bravery and commitment of the SMM monitors serving in the field today. The United States believes the OSCE remains the best means of ending the crisis in Ukraine, as well as addressing many other issues facing the region. For this reason, the United States will maintain its strong support for the OSCE and reject efforts to weaken it, its institutions, or its field missions. Secretary Tillerson urged all member nations to act on our recommendations for a more peaceful and prosperous Europe, Eurasia, and Central Asia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.